Hello and welcome to Newspeak, our weekly look at the news agenda. I'm joined, as usual, I'm pleased to say, by our senior fellow and royal historian, Ralph Hadelman-Coo, Amy Gallagher, who's the SDP's candidate for the mayoralty in London, also the woman behind Stand Up To Woke, and a friend of the channel we haven't seen for a long time, Charles Collum, who is here from Vienna. Actually, he's a commentator, a lecturer, and indeed author. You've just been writing about the Habsburgs, haven't you?
Yes, my last book was on Emperor Karl, the last emperor of Austria.
Yeah.
And I just completed one on his wife, Empress Zita.
Oh, okay. Well, can you come down to our level for the next hour or so?
And
we will talk about various things. Before we talk about the week's news, just a couple of things. Our conference, which is on the 20th of April, has sold out. I'm very pleased that it has. However, if you haven't got tickets, please do, you know, don't give up. We've got a waiting list for possible, you know, returns or whatever. So just let us know if you'd like to go on. But that is very good news. We've still got 2.5 weeks to go. And also, just one note of one of our locals events, which is happening in Manchester this coming Tuesday. That is this Tuesday coming in the evening. It is entirely free. These events are proving to be so popular around the country. So basically, that is the 7th of April, I think, the Tuesday. Anyway, if you would like to come along to that next week in Manchester, just get in touch via, but the best thing is to write to locals at newcultureforum.org.uk. That's in Manchester. We're going to start by, well, we talk a lot about free speech on this show. Starting off with an important and serious and quite depressing anniversary, Ralph, isn't it?
It's an extremely worrying and depressing state of affairs that we are now at the third anniversary of the teacher in Batley who went into hiding for showing his students Charlie Hebdo cartoons depicting Muhammad. He's still in hiding after 3 years, and it's an appalling commentary on the state of free speech in this country and the way in which we have capitulated to Islamic extremism and how we have essentially allowed into this country blasphemy laws by the back door. We now have a blasphemy court in this country, but it's not a court of law, it's a court of mob justice and vigilantes on the street. And it's interesting to contrast our reaction to this terrible event with, for example, the event that happened 5 months prior to this in Britain was, of course, the beheading of Samuel Paty, the French teacher who was beheaded for showing exactly the same cartoon to students in a suburb of Paris. Now, when that happened, there were thousands of people marching in the streets of France. Emmanuel Macron said that he was going to wage war on Islamic extremism. Contrast that with the Batley situation, where essentially the teacher went into hiding, the school apologized, and actually it was West Yorkshire Police who read out a letter of apology to the Muslims about this. And that, you know, it's so telling, therefore, as a result, that if you look, for example, at the nature of France being a secular country that really enforces that idea, 46% of Muslims in France identify as Muslim first and as French second. In Britain, it's 81% of Muslims who identify as Muslim first and British second. Now, that's astonishing. And it's, of course, because the people in this country have never directly challenged Islamic extremism in any way. We kowtow constantly. And, you know, and since the Batley event happened in 2021, the year after that, of course, we had the Shia film was pulled from Cineworld because Sunni Muslims didn't like the Shia film. And so you even had other Muslims having their own sort of blasphemy law targeted against them. And then a year later, we had the even more appalling story of a child who simply dropped a copy of the Quran and slightly damaged the cover. And then an autistic child, and there was a hate crime incident reported against this child, whereas the mob that descended upon the school simply got off scot-free entirely. And I think we've allowed the whip hand to essentially be used against us.
In fact, with that instance, with the dropping of the Quran, if I remember, the mother was sort of paraded on television with police and various local activists, and she actually wore a veil. It was quite an extraordinary sight, you know, of subjugation. Amy, so far as I can work out, no support from any local or national politician for this case.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, the interesting thing about this case was that the school apologised, and then they were backed up by the police, and then the local MPs essentially sympathised with the school's response and didn't back up the teacher, and then the political class, as you say, didn't do anything. And when we talk about the anniversary of this, as though this teacher is somehow dead, he's not dead, he's very much alive, but having to live in hiding, and every day that he lives in hiding is a day that we have capitulated to Islamism. Mm. The political, if our political class were serious and they were robust, they would challenge this. There's been no kind of movement or any MP that's really championed this teacher and helped him and helped to get him out of the situation he's in. And as I said, every day that he is in hiding is a day of, to me, a day that we have failed as a country to, you know, essentially defend our freedoms.
Well, actually, an act of supreme opportunism, Keir Starmer suddenly started talking about this guy, hasn't he? After, you know, this week he talks about the teacher in Batley. Charles, I mean, does this seem crazy to you looking at it from Vienna? Or what is the situation in Vienna with this kind of thing? Is there a sense of free speech being suppressed, particularly when it comes to Islam?
A little, but not nearly as radical.
Yeah.
There's some. Vienna's a very interesting place, of course, because on the one hand you have a political establishment that's very much like the British in the sense of any notice being taken of these sorts of crimes, you're obviously far right. If a brick falls on your head and you notice it, you must be far right, is the implication. And that, however, breeds, I think, more resentment in the Austrian population than it does here. But that having been said, it's not as radical. You don't have, at least so far, an instance of this sort very often. When we, for instance, we had a gunman 2 years ago, All Saints Day, Muslims started shooting up the place in downtown Vienna. And the police were all over it. There were arrests made. It was kind of funny because they arrested something like 20 people in connection with it and claimed it was a lone gunman. They'll say things like that, which is sort of an akin mentality.
Yes.
But it's not quite as crazy.
Yes. It is crazy here. But of course, at the same time, we've got this, you say the police were all over it, right? The police would be over a terrorist incident here, but generally speaking, the police are not over anything, are they?
Well, that's not entirely true. A lady praying by an abortion clinic got arrested very quickly.
When it comes to these kind of issues, it's almost, is it not, like they have sort of made the calculation that in fact they're now almost in a position where they are protecting a majority. Certainly when it comes to the London demonstrations, isn't it?
It's very much the case, and it's also worth noting, of course, that Batley is only about 10 miles or so away from the hot spots of the Muslim Pakistani rape gangs that have been committed, right? West Yorkshire police are particularly culpable for this. They are petrified by political correctness, and they simply are refusing to enforce the law as you would expect it to be enforced. We live in a two-tiered society. You mentioned the protest in London. So, you know, you have tens of thousands of people marching in the streets, jihad being called for, and yet you only have about 10 or so arrests. Contrast that with an EDL march, or English Defence League, which was far smaller, had over 100 arrests. Mm-hmm. The anti-lockdown marches, well over 100 arrests for that. You look at the brutality with which they tried to suppress the women's rights rally in Clapham Common for Sarah Everard. There's absolutely evidence here of two-tier policing that's taking effect. And every time that this happens, it simply emboldens the extremists to go just a bit further. And we're seeing, sort of week by week almost, extremists taking more liberties, and they are weaponizing and using our freedoms against us.
Exactly. This guy, the teacher in Batley, I mean, that's it for him, isn't it? He's going to have to be pretty much anonymous the rest of his life.
Seemingly. I mean, he's been in hiding for 3 years, and the direction that we're going in shows that it looks likely that there's no way he'd be able to come out of hiding. Mm. I mean, Islamism is on the rise, it looks, and our political class are getting weaker, I would say. So actually, if anything, you know, the odds are looking slimmer and slimmer that he would be able to come out of hiding. I mean, there was a report recently by Dame Sarah Khan, which showed that actually a lot of teachers are experiencing threats and intimidation. This isn't a one-off thing. And of course, as Rose said, we've seen lots of incidents of this happening since this happened. And it's got all the way to Parliament with our Speaker in the House, where we're actually seeing MPs no longer able to speak out about Islamism for threats on their life. Mike Freer, of course, the MP for Finchley, said he's stepping down from his role because he was, you know, had an arson attack and he'd been experiencing threats from Islamist groups. And also in terms of schooling, I mean, Catherine Birbal-Singh of the Makeda Free School has also said she's had threats of bombing and threats of violence because she stood up to, you know, bullying within her school around Islamism and pupils being told by other pupils that they had to pray and they had to wear hijab and so on. So this is only getting worse. And yeah, I mean, I think really when this happened, this incident at Batley Grammar School happened 3 years ago, we should have taken that seriously and seen it as a real, you know, we need to stop this thing before it gets worse. And of course we haven't, and well, it has got worse.
Actually, you could say we should have taken Salman Rushdie seriously.
Well, indeed, yeah.
But this has been the most significant thing since the Salman Rushdie case. And, you know, we have to be open about this. We have imported into this country the politics and the culture of Pakistan. You know, politically with arson attacks and death threats and intimidation and mobs protesting outside, but also culturally, you know, I mean, Pakistan is the land we always thought of where blasphemy laws were being implemented with mob justice, people being dragged out into the streets, burnt, killed. How long will it be till we have scenes like that here? And it won't be long, because we're just this week we've had reports of a man being found in Norway dead. Who was famous for burning the Quran in Sweden. This is an ex-Muslim who has been controversially and very provocatively burning the Quran on a regular basis. And now and he was kicked out. Sweden changed the law on burning of the Quran, and he was forced to flee to Norway. But apparently he's been found dead there. And of course, we can probably assume how he died. And I think that we all need to wake up to all of this. And people who say, oh, well, the majority of Muslims are perfectly assimilated. It's true, they are well adjusted, but it's not a sizable majority. There's a very significant minority who hold retrograde, reprehensible views. And actually 62% of Muslims in this country believe that freedom of speech should be suppressed in order to protect religion from criticism.
And that, you know, you're basically ending up with a country within a country. But a country that is much more confident in itself, much more believing in its own identity than the larger country. You know, if you have courage of conviction, you'll do all sorts of things. Even though that conviction is totally wrong, if you have no courage, what do? You smack around the weak and you bow before the powerful. In with and under the ideological issues, there's also a question of moral courage. What the governments in Europe, to a greater or lesser degree, have shown toward this is simple cowardice. It's motivated by their lack of an ideological center. They're really all about government employment, their own. But you cannot counter a positive with a negative. You know, be nice never worked on the schoolyard. I'm going to smack you if you don't stop it. Well, that works. And the fact that people will do whatever they can get away with, and this is true regardless of your religion or your background or your culture, they're emboldened because there are no repercussions to what they have done. Until, you remember the riots in France a few years, 12 years ago, Sarkozy was the interior minister then. They went on and on and on until people started getting deported. It all stopped. It was amazing.
Well, it's a little bit like the wearing of the burqa. People say, oh, you can't possibly enforce that. They say that here. But in fact, where it has become a law, the banning of it, it's worked very well, actually. It has worked really quite well. So I think that there is this sort of feeling in this country of resignation and almost, oh, you can't do that and you shouldn't do that. And there's also a slight difference as well in the this sort of Muslims that are in Britain as opposed to France, say, or possibly even Vienna, you know.
This is also true.
You know, because they're from these kind of very, you know, should we say backward villages, you know, the foothills of the Himalayas or whatever, you know.
It's true. And also, I mean, in France, for instance, a sizable portion of the Muslim element are the descendants of people who fought for France during the Algerian War. You have a minority that are actually very devoted to France in the Muslim community. You may not see that in other places. And of course, whether you come from Turkey versus Iraq versus Tunisia, makes a lot of difference.
Well, the great contrast is between the Muslim population of America compared to the Muslim population of this country, and of course, and North America in general, and the Muslim population tends to be much more middle class than we have in this country, where of course many people came from Pakistan who were from an agricultural background, uneducated, holding essentially, you know, sort of tribal beliefs, and even just in the manner of dress. You don't see people dressed in America and Canada in the same way that you see them adopting traditional dress in this country. And so those sort of distinctions, I think, really tell you a lot about the type of population that we've had here, which we've, you know, I mean, people always say that Canada, for example, is such an open country for multiculturalism. They're actually very clever because they have cherry-picked the very best people from around the world with the highest qualifications to come into that country. At least they used to. They had to have open doors, and more recently, it should be said.
Speaking of courage, you know, or lack or thereof, this week we've had this, we've talked about it on this channel a lot, this extraordinary new Scottish hate crime law.
Yes.
Came in on April the 1st, Monday. It just, without going into the nitty-gritty, it just widens everything a lot, right? It means you can actually be done for something in your own home. It includes in it a lot more identities, not just protected characteristics in the old sense, but, you know, gender identity and all this. J.K. Rowling basically put it to the test, didn't she, Amy, on Monday. Is that courageous, or you could say she can afford to be courageous if one's going to be cynical? What?
I think it was courageous. Yeah, it was on April the 1st that she tweeted a series of tweets showing examples of men who were claiming to be women who had who were sex offenders or paedophiles, who were essentially gaming the system, who were claiming to be women so that they could enter a women's prison, or had threatened women in some way, showing the whole farce of kind of transgender ideology, essentially. She tweeted 10 of them, examples of kind of very sadistic criminal males who were claiming to be women. And she was actually sort of saying, oh, isn't it brilliant how inclusive we are? And then she said, oh, it's April Fool's, actually, I don't think it's inclusive. And then she dared the police to investigate her, because, as you say, the broadening of the hate crime legislation means that stirring up of hatred can also be applied to people within the transgender protected characteristic. And it also broadens that it's not just threats of violence, it could also be anything that seemed to be abusive. And of course, abusive can be interpreted in all sorts of ways. So that's what she was putting to the test. And the Scottish police said that essentially they weren't going to investigate J.K. Rowling. They didn't deem her tweets to be abusive or within their, you know, within the legislation, which is, I guess, the fact that she was testing it out and the fact that people were waiting to see how the police in Scotland will react really shows how subjective all of this legislation is, because we don't know why it is that they didn't investigate her, you know. And a lot of people in the trans kind of lobby are saying, well, why wasn't she investigated? Because I feel offended by this. So it just shows that nobody really knows the lay of the land. Nobody really knows how to interpret these laws.
Well, she lives in Edinburgh, doesn't she? And this is Scottish law, but the way that the war, you mentioned the subjectivity, the way that the law is worded is, if this is considered to be hateful by the victim, they use that word, the victim, or anybody else, that is in the law, if all hate speech, right?
Yes.
So technically, don't you think that also means that someone in England could maybe take offence at something? You know, I mean, this subjective, we've never had this in British law, really, this kind of subjectivity. They say if the victim feels that, well, first of all, surely it should be the complainant, shouldn't it? It shouldn't be, if you say something's the victim, you're already assuming that they've got a point. That they've got
guilty before proven innocent.
Yes, exactly. So this is kind of completely...
And this was shown up by people that on the day of April the 1st made complaints. Not just about J.K. I mean, lots of complaints came in about J.K. Rowling, people not just in Scotland but in England as well, as you say, but also people kind of who wanted to protest against this law made loads of complaints against Hamza Yousaf himself, the Minister for Scotland, who gave this speech of, you know, detailing authority figures who are white and saying, using the word white repeatedly in an aggressive way to somehow suggest that it was somehow bad, that 96% of Scotland is, which is, you know, are white, and that the authority figures are white. And actually there was more complaints against Hamza Yousaf than there was against J.K. Rowling, and neither of them have obviously been investigated, which just shows that nobody really knows that, well, firstly, a lot of people are unhappy with this law, but actually nobody really knows what is hate speech and what isn't. Mm. And I think with J.K. Rowling, I mean, your point about how she's, you know, she is very wealthy and very powerful, though, so she can afford to do this. But what she has said is that any woman in Scotland who is investigated by the police for saying that a man can't be a woman, she will repeat the words that that woman has said in order to protect women who, unlike her, don't have the financial means to protect themselves. So I do think she's brave. And I think, you know, we need to be questioning, you know, what if J.K. Rowling didn't exist, or she didn't have the power and money that she had, where would we be? It really, it does seem that our freedoms really are relying on a few people at this point, which is Elon Musk of Twitter and J.K. Rowling, and it's very worrying. I mean, it's wonderful what they're doing, but you do think, gosh, it really is coming down to a few people in terms of our future freedoms.
I think it should become an iSpartacus moment for the Scottish and the British people. So it's not just the J.K. Rowlings of this world, but all of us should stand together as one and expose the absurdity of this legislation, the absurdity of not even being able to properly define the word hate, the absurdity of somebody with, you know, a great chip on their shoulder, taking offence at the slightest sort of a raised eyebrow or whatever. I just hope that we somehow get a repeat of what happened with Nicola Sturgeon. Remember, it was the absurdity of gender self-identification that destroyed Nicola Sturgeon's career with this stupid piece of legislation which saw men going into women's prisons and so forth. That signaled the end of Sturgeon's career. I only hope that something similar happens when the Scottish people realise what an absolutely disastrous piece of legislation this is, how bad it is, and how embarrassing it is for the Scottish people to have this, and that this will somehow force maybe either a repeal or force, you know, force Hamza Yousaf out of office.
It also, you know, it underlines several things at once. Firstly, the vaguer a law is, the more power it gives the government in charge. And not just the government in charge, but the mere executives of the law. Mm-hmm. Truth becomes whatever I say it is, because of the vagueness of the wording. We have a phrase back in the States which I really love, hate facts.
Hate facts.
It's something that's true, but shouldn't be. And you're a bad person if you mention it. It's a hate fact. Well, that kind of insane approach to reality, I mean, if you think about it, it's something that we're constantly dealing with from the governing circles today. A total lack of connection to lived reality. The fantasy, the imagination becomes the reality for them.
Actually, in America, please tell me if I'm wrong, but there aren't officially hate speech laws, are there?
Well, there are. It depends on where you live. I mean, one of the differences between the United States and Britain, there are several, but we have many, many jurisdictions. We have 50 states and many counties, et cetera, and depending on the state, depending on the city, et cetera, you've got differing laws. But of course, we also have the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, one article which covers freedom of speech. Now, I don't know how it would work here, but in the United States, a law like this would be challenged in court, just like that, because it's so egregious. it's breathtaking. Because even our hate speech laws, in the places where we have them, they have to be kind of explicit. We also have a concept of hate crime, which is if something is determined, and again, it's been an open door to all kinds of madness, but if I shoot you, all right, that's a crime. But if it's determined that I shot you because of your identity, that becomes a hate crime. You know, and the madness there, again, is that it should be enough of a crime. The fact that I shot you should be enough to put me away. You shouldn't really need to go after more.
But you raise an interesting point here, and that is that this is not unique to Scotland. This is an Anglospheric issue, and it's something you don't see in the you never see this in the Mediterranean, for example, or in Eastern Europe. This is a problem we're seeing now in Ireland. Ireland has enacted just equally as bad legislation, a chilling effect on free speech. In Canada, there's now proposed legislation that would enable a judge to put you under house arrest if they think that there is a potential that you may commit a hate crime in the future. Now, that is thought crime. And this is absolutely Orwellian, you know, Kafkaesque sort of stuff that's going on. And it is, you know, the woke mind virus is a woke mind virus emanating from America. But thankfully, America has this First Amendment right of free speech, which we would benefit from.
And repeatedly.
I think actually one possible point, well, one of the reasons why this is in the Anglospheric countries is that they have all of them experienced unprecedented levels of migration, and in order to make that work, they were quite open about it at one point. You have to restrict freedom of speech in order for people to get along. So in other words, what we've ended up with, you might say, is a kind of tyranny of the minorities, right? But therefore you have to somehow, in order at this scale, in order for people to get on, you have to somehow make sure people don't say certain things, which seems to be the case in all of these countries. Obviously, Europe's had immigration too, but
it's true. But the problem here, what makes it problematic, is who makes these decisions. Upon what right do they make them? The legitimacy, and that's an important word, legitimacy of those making these decisions for us is something that has to be questioned.
Well, they don't have any.
No.
They have none. They have no.
What's interesting is that the only countries in Europe that come close to the Anglosphere are the Scandinavian nations and the Netherlands. And what do they have in common? They speak English as fluently as we do. So they have the same exposure to these radical ideas that are emanating from America and elsewhere. And they are also the countries most affected by immigration.
You remember a while ago, it's a couple of months ago now, but on the Piers Morgan show on Talk TV, Richard Dawkins, you know, the famous atheist writer, refused point blank to actually answer questions because of his, presumably, his fear of Islamic radicals.
Yes, it was amazing. He just shut down, didn't he? He said, I don't want to answer that. And because he's such a sort of outspoken, quite robust figure, it was quite surprising to see him react like that. And I think it links into what we're saying, in that in the area of transgenderism and women's rights, you know, there's a lot of people pushing back, but people aren't going to push back, I think, in the area of challenging Islam. Because I think, you know, if you think of people that have spoken about out, like Tommy Robinson and various other people, nobody seems to want to protect those people, or the Batley Grammar School teacher. Nobody's coming, there's no billionaire kind of authors coming to their defense. And actually, I think it's, you know, I think it's very concerning, really, generally, that it's the area of Islamism, which is the thing that people, where freedoms will be shut down, I think. That's the issue, and nobody's coming to the
They're not, but also because they follow through.
Exactly, that's it. There's a real fear.
They follow through on the thing.
Well, just look at comedians. You know, everyone says, "Oh, look how amazing Ricky Gervais is, or Dave Chappelle. How brave they are." Well, yeah, because they're going after the trans community, who aren't going to be a great threat. Never do they ever comment about Islam. Never do they comment about Black Lives Matter and these sorts of issues. So even these great sort of free speech, you know, flag bearers have the areas which are no-go zones for them too.
One thing I did want to expand the conversation a bit. Mention Richard Dawkins there. He was on TV again. I think it was Talk TV this week, and it caused a bit of a flurry, at least on social media. here's a man who's sort of made his name in being an intellectual atheist, written many books. But he was essentially saying in this interview, which we're just going to have a look at a clip of it, but he was essentially saying, I'm a kind of cultural Christian, and I sort of regret the disappearance, if that happens, of certain artifacts of Christianity. And also, I'd prefer it to Islam. Just to take a, have a look before we talk about this.
You know, I love hymns and Christmas carols, and I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense. It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we, certainly if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
Well, which brings me to my supplementary point, which is that, as we know, church attendance is plummeting, but the building, the erection of mosques across Europe, I think 6,000 are under construction, and there are many more, I mean, are being planned. So do you think, do you regard that as a problem? Do you think that matters?
Yes, I do, really. I mean, I have to choose my words carefully. I mean, if I had to choose between Christianity and Islam, I'd choose Christianity every single time. I mean, it seems to me to be a fundamentally decent religion, in a way that I think Islam is not.
That's caused quite a bit of fuss, sir. I mean, first of all, to take his point, do you think he's being hypocritical by saying this after having basically, I would say, you could say, chipped away at Christianity for about as long as possible, and then suddenly he's turning around saying, well, actually, I do like cathedrals and I like the music. Do you think?
Yeah, he's always described himself as culturally Christian. This isn't a new thing. I mean, in this interview, you do see how he says it's a really good thing that belief in Christian belief has gone down, but I wouldn't want to lose it. I wouldn't want to lose the churches. And you think, well, the two are totally related. They're not unrelated, are they? if nobody believes it, nobody goes to church, then eventually the churches will shut down. Mm. You can't have the little bit of it that you like, but not the bit of it that you don't like. Mm. And he was also speaking about how, you know, he really thinks that, you know, if you compare Islam to Christianity, he much prefers Christianity. And he's very concerned that our Christian culture is being replaced with Islam. And you do sort of think, well, what did you think would happen?
Yes.
When you got rid of something, it's like Chesterton's fence. If you get rid of something and there's a void, something will fill the void. What did you think it would fill? I mean, Dawkins has been very outspoken about woke ideology and speaking about the importance of biology in defining men and women. And he clearly has issues with Islam, even though he's kind of doesn't want to speak out about it. And you think, well, these are the two new religions. It's the woke religion or Islam. And those are your choices. And he has spent his whole life deriding Christianity, without any sort of foresight to think, well, actually, if we do away with this, there will be something that fills. There is a desire in all of us, I think, for the religious or for the spiritual. And actually, it's more of a kind of, which one do you want? Which is the better one?
You see, I can't help feeling when I hear these sort of things. It's a bit like, you know, they used to say neocons are liberals who've been mugged by reality.
Oh.
I sort of can't help feeling when I look at people like Dawkins, I sort of think, you know, basically you're having your cake and eating it, actually. And also, you know, you've spent a lot of your time making our lives misery for maybe being, not me in this case, I have to say, but believers, Christian believers. You know, you've really sort of like gone for them. And then now you're sort of like, oh, what's a bit of a shame, really?
He reminds me, in a certain sense, of the Magician's Apprentice.
Yeah.
You know, who raised up the demon and then didn't like the fact that he was there and had to deal with
it.
Well, these people are their ideological ancestors for three centuries have been chipping away at everything that made Europe, at everything that made the West. Mm. And, I mean, that's not, for the believer, that's not its importance. It's a byproduct. Mm. But that byproduct we've all benefited from. Mm. And to say, I mean, on the one hand, I'm glad he's figured it out. You know, it's you know, if he just kept on saying the same stupid stuff, that it speaks well for his brain that he's noticing reality.
I take issue with this, actually. Before you go on, when you say it says well for his brain, this is an argument that's often put to, you know, with lefties. They sort of say, oh, well, you know, he's seen the light. You know, Nick Cohen has sort of seen the light. And you sort of think, no, it just means that you were slower intellectually.
Yeah. Well, it was slower. And also, he doesn't like the results. Yeah. As I say, he's called up the demon, and he's not happy with it. But having said that, the other half of it, though, is that he wants to continue to benefit from something that he doesn't believe in. Mm. Now, you know, if you make, this is a very bad simile, but if you're making money selling amulets and you don't believe in the spirits that the amulets are supposed to protect you against, well, you're a hypocrite.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're kind of a thief.
Mm.
So.
Yeah.
And we went, as we said earlier, with the rise of Islam. Again, you can't counter a positive with a negative.
Mm.
It's not just the Christian belief makes nice things, and also in one sense it's not just that it's true, it's that without it, there is simply nothing to stop Islamism.
Mm.
It's not going to go away with wokery, and if you get repressive, if you actually got someone to respond to these threats and to smack back at them, upon what basis?
Yes. Do you think there's anything in the, generally, not just in the Dawkins case, but like, as I said, in kind of commentators and writers, that it's rather like the adolescent who always thinks the parents are going to be around?
Yeah.
You know, who rebels against the parents, who tears up, you know, but they always think they're going to be there. I remember something someone once said, this was about the satire. The kind of great fashion for satire in the 60s, you know, that was the week that was, all of that. I think someone once asked him, it might even have been John Cleese, would you, if you had known what was going to happen, would you have been so fierce? And I think what they said in so many words was, well, we always thought it was going to be there. Mm. You always thought Macmillan was going to be there, right? Mm. You always thought the royals and the Church of England and all the rest of it. But you can mock these things to absolute oblivion, can't you?
You can. And it's sort of the thing, and it's partially, I suppose, a generational thing, speaking as a junior boomer. But it's the feeling that daddy is always going to be there, and you can kick daddy's leg, and you can scream at him, but he'll always be there, and he'll always come across with food and money when you need it. Then you wake up one day and daddy's dead.
I think what's happened is that people have realized once you get rid of the parent or daddy, as you say, and you have to go out into the real world, all you do is come across other new parental figures, maybe your boss, maybe your manager, maybe the law. Mm. And actually those new parental figures aren't anywhere near as nice or compassionate or as loving as your actual parents, which is what Christianity is. You know, it's the thing
precisely
that is a genuinely good philosophical, you know, theological structure. And actually all the new structures aren't anywhere near as loving and as tolerant as the one we had. And I think that's what we're facing. I think Richard Dawkins, I mean, he often calls religion childish, but I think he's been very childish and very lacking in foresight to realise that actually this rebellion that he's been on for all of his life has actually meant he's sort of left out in the cold. He has no one there for him now.
I don't like it when people call things childish. You know, like Republicans always call the monarchy childish, doesn't it? Say, we've got to grow up.
Mm.
You see, how dare you? Mm. Something that's been there for like 1,000 years, you know. Now, when you're talking about growing up,
it is grown up.
You tell me to grow up.
You know? How much more? So things that are around for 1,000 years, how much more grown up can it get?
Exactly, yes. Well, look, we put the world to rights, haven't we? As I hope you rely on us to do on this program every week. Thank you very much for joining us on this occasion, Charles. Thank you, Amy. Thanks, Rob, very much. We'll see you next time. In the meantime, remember, Manchester this coming week on Tuesday. If you want to come, please do get in touch, won't you? Okay, thank you. Bye. Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.